listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde, and we're very blessed to be joined by the chair of the New Zealand Initiative, Roger Partridge. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Rodney.
You've written a great report. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's about the Supreme Court. It's about the overreach of the Supreme Court, the idea that the Supreme Court is very often making the law, subverting Parliament, and indeed subverting our centuries-old common law. These are quite heavy charges, Roger.
They are. The report really zeroes in on a growing power struggle between Parliament and the courts. And as I say in the report, it has far-reaching consequences for our democracy and for what lawyers call the rule of law. For non-lawyers, the rule of law connotes ideas of the impartiality of the judiciary and the consistency and predictability of judicial decision-making, which is essential for citizens and businesses as they go about their everyday life. They need to know what the law means. And the problem stems from a series of increasingly misguided decisions between New Zealand's highest court, the Supreme Court, which has seen the court blurring the lines, if you like, between judges' traditional role of interpreting and applying the law and Parliament's job of making the law.
Just back up a couple of steps. First up, is there a problem? I always thought there was, if you're a lawyer criticising your judiciary.
The rules direct you as a lawyer not to criticise the judicial personalities, but there's nothing to stop you criticising the court's legal method. In fact, okay, it's essential in a healthy democracy.
So you can't say Judge so-and-so is a lying drunk.
Yeah.
But you could say that Judge so-and-so's decisions are inconsistent.
Or misguided or erroneous. And that's what the report does. And, of course, that's what the law journals are full of. Critiques.
Totally.
Critiques of legal decisions.
I was thinking mostly, however, by academic professors of law.
Well, by academics and non-academics alike, senior lawyers in the profession routinely will critique cases, decisions, legal principles, as well as academics. Of course, it's more the field of academic lawyers.
Yeah. We will get into the detail, but
I should say I'm in a hybrid role in a sense, not a member of a law school, but at a think tank performing much the same role with research on public policy issues, in this case on the law. And I was a practicing lawyer for 35 or so, maybe close to 40 years. I ceased to be a practicing lawyer a couple of years ago.
Just for listeners, tell us about, we never used to have a Supreme Court constitutionally. For New Zealand, let alone the Westminster system, it's a relatively new thing. Why we got one?
It was introduced in 2003. Our final Court of Appeal until then was the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, made up in the main of members of the English or UK House of Lords, supplemented with judges from around the Commonwealth. And I think at least by the 90s, but towards the end of the 20th century, the sense had developed that New Zealand was a mature enough democracy and a mature enough legal system not to need to go to the other side of the world for its final appellate rights. And I, for one, agreed with that and still do. For the last 20 years, our final Court of Appeal has been a local court, the Supreme Court.
There's something of a virtue, though, you must admit, of being able to go to a different jurisdiction, away from the political argy-bargy, particularly in a small country,
yes,
and stand in a system of which you're a derived structure, the Westminster system, and you do have a sense that the judges at the Privy Council say don't have a dog in the race, the same that the judges might have here in New Zealand?
Well, I think it's certainly true that the Privy Council was more detached. And you could have a debate about whether that was a good or a bad thing.
But anyway, we've got it.
We've got it. We've got the Supreme Court.
Margaret Wilson, when she was introducing the Supreme Court idea, suggested that this was a very important thing to have because we needed to develop our own New Zealand law, which I regard as rather frightening.
Well, of course, most of our law is New Zealand law, if you like, because most of our law is made by Parliament. There are three primary sources of law every law student is taught: statute law, the common law, which is judge-made law, and customs, which can give rise to law. But most of our law is local because of the increasing tendency for Parliament to codify the common law. So a lot of what was covered by old common law principles is now covered by statutes, contract law, defamation, and so on. Torts of personal injury were replaced by the accident compensation scheme, and so on.
So we have the Supreme Court. Its job is what?
Its job is generally backward-looking to adjudicate, and this is the job of the courts generally. The Supreme Court is the final court, appellate court. But its job is to adjudicate on disputes between parties by identifying relevant facts that will have been heard and found in the court below and applying the law to them. So the role of our courts is primarily a backwards-looking one. And that might sound strange, but it's worth thinking about in the context that we have three branches to our government. Parliament, made up of elected representatives, determined by voters, the executive, and the judiciary. And broadly, they have three different functions. Parliament's job is to make the law for the future, so it's forward-looking. The executive's job, so the cabinet and the bureaucracy, is to apply the law in the present. And the role of the courts is generally a past-looking one, a backwards-looking one, to determine disputes, between particular litigants. And what we're seeing increasingly with the Supreme Court's, I think, quite radical legal method is to supplant Parliament's role and to adopt a forward-looking approach, trying to take the law or to develop the law and take it on a journey. And I think that's very dangerous because it involves the court making big social policy decisions, which it's not well suited to make. Parliament's got many more tools at its disposal. It can ask the Law Commission, or the executive can ask the Law Commission to produce a report. If legislation is introduced, it's then subject to a broad submission-making process where anybody interested in the issue can have their say. The bureaucracy officials can undertake cost-benefit assessment of any proposed law reform changes, so we have the regulatory impact statement process. And, of course, the other big benefit that Parliament has in making big social policy decisions is it's democratically accountable. If voters don't like it, they can throw they can bring about a change of government at an election. So if the Supreme Court's to be making those big social policy decisions, it doesn't have the general investigative powers of Parliament. It's not subject to the broad submission-making process. Generally, it gets submissions from the parties before the court. Sometimes there are outside interveners, But it's by no means the breadth of submission-making process you get with the select committee process. And, of course, judges aren't politically accountable. So that if they take the law off into a direction that that voters don't like, there's nothing voters can do to throw them out. Of course, Parliament can intervene and overturn court decisions or redirect the direction of the law if it doesn't like it. But judges lack the democratic accountability of Parliament. And I think that's a big shortcoming when it comes to making important social policy changes.
This delicate interplay of the three branches of government is very poorly understood by the general public. However, it is vital to the Westminster system. It is vital to understanding the rules under which we live and being able to be free. And it is something that law students would learn, I would think, in Legal Studies 101.
Indeed they do.
So how is it that our Supreme Court, the best and the brightest of your profession, stand accused, not just by you, but by so many, including Parliament and the Executive, of getting it so wrong?
Yes, well, that's a good question. And especially when you think about the cautionary tale that is the United States, where you can see what happens when judges become lawmakers and effectively politicize the judicial role by making big social policy decisions. The activist approach of the US Supreme Court's led to less certain and predictable laws. It's led to a loss of trust and confidence in the impartiality of the judiciary, and I think it's fair to say an erosion of the democratic legitimacy of the United States legal system. And to come back to your question, I think our senior judges seem blind to these risks, and are intent on taking us down the same dangerous path. One of the beauties of our legal system traditionally is that if you ask the average voter in New Zealand to name a Supreme Court judge, they probably couldn't, but they probably could name a US Supreme Court
judge. That's true.
And I think not being able to name a Supreme Court judge is exactly what you want. You don't want the identity of a particular judge or the makeup of a particular court to be relevant. The courts should be impartial, non-political, and effectively anonymous. But the path we're going down risks politicizing the judiciary in the way that we see in the Supreme Court in the US.
You gave a couple of examples. The one that struck me was three strikes, and the other one that struck me was in common law tikanga in the Peter Ellis case. Explain those two briefly.
Right. So they're illustrations of two separate problems that the report zeroes in on the Supreme Court's legal method. The first is that it's given itself a lot of license when it comes to interpreting Parliament's words. And by Parliament's words, I mean statutes or acts, as they're also known. It's now given itself license to stretch, and sometimes I think it's fair to say even ignore Parliament's clear intent. And the Fitzgerald case is an example of that. And let's come back to Fitzgerald in a moment. But the other area where its method is subject of concern is its common law method. So the method it adopts in relation to common law principles, which derive from decided cases over the centuries that are one of the sources of law, judge-made law. And there, the traditional common law method is one of incremental development and reliance on precedent. So people know where they stand because they can work out what the legal principles are from cases decided in the past. And in relation to the common law, The Supreme Court judges have repeatedly said, both in cases and in their writings, academic writings, that they see their job as to develop the common law in line with society's changing social values. And the report argues that that's a radical approach. It's an undesirable one because the courts are ill-equipped to determine society's changing values. For the reasons I explained before, they don't have all of the toolkit that Parliament has when it decides to look at changing the law. And Ellis is an example of that, and I discuss that in the report. So coming back to Fitzgerald, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so as you say, it's the three strikes case, legislation passed by a national-led government. Now, people will have differing views on it. Your audience might like it. I didn't particularly, but it required the courts to impose the maximum sentence on a third qualifying offence, a third, I suppose, serious offence. Section 86D of the Sentencing Act said, despite any other enactment, the court shall impose the maximum sentence on a third strike. Mr. Fitzgerald committed a third strike offence. It was relatively low level. It was categorised as a sexual assault, but it involved kissing a woman without her consent. And he was duly sentenced to 7 years in jail, which many people might, me included, would have regarded as an unjust outcome. But that was the law. And the Supreme Court navigated its way around a very clear statutory provision. And I say the Supreme Court, it was a majority decision. There was a very strong dissent from Justice Willie Young, who said that this wasn't interpreting the law, this was rewriting the law. And he said that the words, despite any other enactment, admitted of no ifs, buts, or maybes. The majority judges took a different view, and it's a vote, effectively, and it went 4-1 in Mr. Fitzgerald's favour. And you can see that as leading to a just result, but it's a very dangerous precedent because it involves the court ignoring Parliament's clear wording. And the danger there is the lack of legal certainty that follows if people can't rely on what's written in statutes as being the law because the courts might take a different view. Mm. It also, of course, undermines the parliamentary sovereignty. And it was expressly stipulated in the 2003 Act setting up the Supreme Court, but nothing in the Act. When Parliament established the Supreme Court, and it was Parliament said nothing in this Act affects New Zealand's ongoing commitment to the sovereignty of Parliament or the rule of law. Sovereignty of Parliament means Parliament's supreme, so it's above the courts, and the rule of law connotes, as I said at the outset, certainty and predictability. And we have here really the antithesis of that.
Irrespective of whether you support the law or not, that particular legislation, whether you agree with the policy or not, it was a bombshell decision because there was no interpretation possible of what Parliament said. Parliament Yes. could have it wrong. They could have made a mistake. But that's to be corrected by voters in the Parliament. So the Supreme Court clearly could understand what Parliament was saying, didn't like the result, and so decided to ignore the statute.
That's effectively right. Now, to fully understand Fitzgerald, you have to understand that the interplay between ordinary statutes and the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act.
Mm.
Now, the Bill of Rights sets out rights a bit like the US Constitution, but unlike the US Constitution, it's not overriding or superior law. It's just an ordinary statute. But it does protect rights like the right to freedom of speech. It provides that the rights protected must be subject only to reasonable limitations, and it gives and the courts now have created a power to declare a piece of legislation inconsistent with the Bill of Rights. That doesn't invalidate it, unlike the U.S. Supreme Court. But more relevantly, for present purposes, the Bill of Rights Act says that where a piece of legislation conflicts with a right protected by the Bill of Rights, and one of the rights is against unfair punishment, and that was accepted to be in play in the Fitzgerald case, disproportionate.
Mm. But you and I know that's sophistry, right?
What's that?
Using the Bill of Rights in that way.
Well, the Bill of Rights says that we're whenever an enactment can be given a meaning that is consistent with the rights and freedoms contained in the Bill of Rights, that meaning shall be preferred to any other meaning. Now,
and I would support that.
Yes. With some qualifications. Mm. Up until Fitzgerald, the courts had accepted that the meaning that they adopt that's right consistent with the Bill of Rights must be reasonable. It must be reasonably available one. In Fitzgerald, the court rejected that restriction, and I should say that requirement that the interpretation is a reasonable interpretation of Parliament's word. It might be a bit of a stretch, but it's still got to be reasonable. Was something the Supreme Court, the need for it to be reasonable, was something the Supreme Court had consistently affirmed, and most recently in an important case called Aaron Hansen, when Justice Sean Elias was Chief Justice. But in Fitzgerald, the court said the word reasonable doesn't appear in Section 6 of the Bill of Rights Act, and so there's no need for the interpretation we're going to prefer to be a reasonable one. I think it follows that the court's saying it's happy to accept an unreasonable interpretation.
Mm.
And that's highly unsatisfactory. So Justice Young, in his dissenting judgment, said that effectively the majority's decision involved reading the Section 86D of the Sentencing Act, the three strikes provision, in the following way. So that the words as enacted say, despite any other enactment, and Willie Young then says, but we've got to read in, but not including the Bill of Rights Act 1990.
Mm.
If on any occasion an offender is convicted of one or more stage three offences other than murder, the High Court must sentence the offender to the maximum term of imprisonment prescribed for each offence, and then the following words read in, but must not do so if this would result in a disproportionately severe punishment under Section 9 of the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act. Now, the court can presume that Parliament is aware of the Bill of Rights requirements 25 years or so after its enactment. Two decades at the time of the Fitzgerald case, 2021. My contention and that of others is this was a rewriting, and that was also the view of Justice Young in his strong dissent. So that's the Fitzgerald case.
We also have, to me, utterly bizarre, the Ellis case. Talk us through that one.
So the Peter Ellis case, it's the continuance decision. So Peter Ellis, wrongly convicted, he was applying to continue a piece of litigation. His estate was applying to continue a piece of litigation after his death. And traditionally, under our law, cases of that nature come to an end when you die.
And that's a common law position.
That's a common law position. Now, the Supreme Court overturned that, which seems quite a just outcome. But in doing so, they intervened in the hearing and asked the council to make submissions on whether tikanga might be relevant. Now, the case didn't have a Maori connection. So that was, and the parties hadn't argued tikanga. So it was the Supreme Court initiating this issue. And
so they were casting around for a reason and suggested the parties give them one.
Well, they didn't in the end need to rely on tikanga. So I think they were, I think it's fair to infer that the court was looking to say something about tikanga and this was an opportunity. And the report contends that that's not the impartial judiciary that we expect. Courts shouldn't have an agenda. They should be deciding disputes between litigants, having regard to the law as it was when the dispute arose, not trying to develop the law or take it on a journey. And there's nothing, the problem here is not tikanga. Tikanga has always, in certain circumstances, I say always, for more than a century, in certain circumstances, been recognised by the common law as having the force of law. As I said at the beginning, there are three sources of law: statutes, the common law, and custom. And custom can be both general custom applying to the jurisdiction generally, or local custom or specific applying to a group. And since the decision of the High Court in 1908 in Loseby, where the court had held that a tikanga practice was sufficiently certain to have the court the force of law. In that case, it was the requirement that the iwi or hapu were collectively responsible for funeral costs, which was part of tikanga, was applied, and it allowed the executor of the state to recover the cost of the funeral from the collective. And common law has a test for when custom is sufficiently certain to have the force of law. The Supreme Court in Ellis made some disparaging comments about the common law principles, said it was overruling the rule of recognition for tikanga as custom in Loseby, but didn't replace the Loseby test with any other test. And that you can infer from the judgment that the court is suggesting that any issue before the court might need to be considered through a tikanga lens. But I think the decision's flawed on a number of grounds, and I'm happy to run into those. But the big point is that it has left the law in it's left a quagmire.
Because... well, no one knows what this tikanga is.
Yes, and nobody knows when it will have the force of law or when it's relevant.
It's only it's going to be up to when it suits the Supreme Court one way or the other, essentially.
Yes, exactly.
And this is your point. Yet in doing so, they have undermined the rules by which we are running our society.
Well, they've left the law, they've undermined the rule of law by creating uncertainty and a lack of predictability, which are essential requirements for the rule of law. So, just like in the Fitzgerald case, there was an extremely strong dissent, in this case from two justices, Justice Arnold and Justice O'Regan, who expressed concern that the majority judgment had not addressed a wide number of questions that were needed to give the new legal rules the majority was trying to introduce the sort of certainty we need to maintain the rule of law. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read through their questions, or I suggest I do. It'll be interesting, I think, enough for your listeners. So difficult issues of both legal and constitutional significance had not been addressed, they said, and they included: how can the court identify when tikanga is relevant to the case at hand and when it is not? If it is relevant, how should it be addressed? Whether tikanga is a separate or third source of law? How the relevant tikanga should be brought to the court's attention? how the application of tikanga in one area of the law affects the common law in another area, how to avoid tikanga being distorted by the courts, how to address the fundamental difference in approach to wrongful conduct and issues of social order between tikanga Māori and the common law. So the widest array of questions left unanswered. And so I think it's fair to say we're left with a quagmire. And that is.
And again, a successful student at the end of their course in Legal Studies 101 would be able to answer that in an exam question.
Well, wouldn't be able to answer that, I venture.
They'd put the objections up. Yeah. I mean, they could explain this, and yeah. Yet the Supreme Court has done it.
What makes it all the more remarkable is that even as the Supreme Court was considering the tikanga issue, the minister had asked the Law Commission to prepare a detailed report on tikanga. So the sort of inquiry process that the Parliament and the Executive are well suited to, ask a body of experts, go out and seek submissions, come back, let the Executive consider the report, and perhaps come up with a statutory scheme and then subject the statutory scheme to the submission-making process. So all of that would have thrown up the questions identified by the minority judges and come up with some answers to them and led to Parliament enacting a statutory scheme in relation to the recognition of tikanga that answered, that created enough certainty that we weren't left with a quagmire that we are today, or that we have today. Despite the parties themselves not raising it in the Ellis case, the Supreme Court rushed in and has left us with this, I think, very unsatisfactory position. It's a very unsatisfactory outcome, and it's a very unsatisfactory legal method adopted by the court.
You put it very politely, because the risks here are huge, because part of living in a free society is knowing the rules and how they're going to be applied. No citizen in New Zealand now knows that.
That's right.
The second thing that keeps us in order is that Parliament refrains and the Executive refrain from sacking judges who make decisions they don't like.
That's right, and that's a good thing too.
Absolutely.
But part of the deal is that judges stay in their lane.
Yes, and so we're in a situation now for quite a while that the Executive and Parliament are extremely, angry would be too mild. And their advisors, very, very conservative in terms of their legal advice, are scathing of the courts and how they will take a policy that government has come up with and Parliament has passed and twist and turn it.
Yes.
So that there's a danger of our branches of government getting into a tit-for-tat situation, which you are akin to a third world scenario, or
there is a danger.
Dictatorship.
There is a danger. And the court seems blind to this. The outcome is we end up with a politicized judiciary.
Yes. Well, it's politicized itself, hasn't it, by its decision making?
It is politicizing itself. And the last thing we want, and the last thing the judiciary should want, is for ordinary citizens to feel like they need to know the names of the judges, mm-hmm. and for people to think that the identity of the makeup of a particular Supreme Court bench or court bench is relevant to the outcome. Mm. That's the last thing we want. We want the court, and that's the main reason why we haven't got onto what I recommend.
That's what we're going to do now. How do we fix it?
So when I set out to write this report, it really initiated by a wonderful paper written by Jack Hodder, who's a senior KC. He's a former law commissioner himself. He was on the Attorney General's advisory group for the establishment of the Supreme Court. And he wrote a paper for a conference held earlier this year, run by the Legal Research Foundation to commemorate 20 years since the establishment of the Supreme Court. I was once for about a decade, the executive director of the Legal Research Foundation and one of its honorary fellows. And Jack sent me his paper ahead of the conference, I read it and realized that it was a far-reaching critique of the Supreme Court. And I have stood on Jack's shoulders in writing my paper. And what I'd intended to do was just to write a report about what Parliament might do to address the concerns Jack raised. And as I got into writing it, I realized I really had to lay the foundations for the recommendations in the report itself. But it's the back end of the report that is really where I started. Mm. And there's five things I recommend, five specific recommendations. They fall into three categories. The first relates to Parliament's most blunt instrument, which is specific legislation over either clarifying or correcting what it thinks is a mistake made by the courts. Parliament is supreme in our legal hierarchy. It sits above the courts. It created the Supreme Court. And if it thinks the Supreme Court has erred, it can correct it by passing a specific act of Parliament. Now, that's not an easy thing for Parliament to do, and there might be a lot of disruption in the meantime, which we're already seeing with the Ellis case. But I think
the Ellis case is tough because it's a concept. But if they just take the Fitzgerald one, would it be something like Parliament saying, we're passing this particular statute to quash the Fitzgerald decision and to make clear Parliament meant exactly what it said?
That's right. So what if Parliament had said, despite any other enactment, including the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act 1990, I don't think in Fitzgerald the Supreme Court would have had any wiggle room. So that's the formula Parliament will have to adopt.
Got it. But which is crazy, right?
Well, it was clear enough.
I mean, it's crazy that Parliament has to, you know, the process of getting laws through Parliament to correct the bloody decision that these. Well, I'm careful what I say.
With the three strikes legislation, Parliament had envisaged a process which would avoid the sort of injustice that occurred with Fitzgerald, because there was a screening process so that undeserving third strike offenders would not be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. That was a suboptimal approach, in my opinion, but it was nevertheless there, and that formed part of the reasons why Justice Willie Young said, "Of course, Parliament intended this rule to apply despite the Bill of Rights Act." Anyway,
so just on that one point, that's going to get into a tit for tat fighting situation, isn't it? They make a decision, Parliament responds. Supreme Court makes a decision, Parliament responds.
Yes,
not ideal.
It's not ideal, but it's happened in the past. Labor did it when a case discussed in the report called D and the Police, and there were Jack Hodder politely describes in his lecture, small stirrings of irritation in the Parliament. That case involved the sex offenders register, and Parliament thought it was passing a law that would apply retrospectively, and the courts said, "Well, you didn't really address it clearly enough, and so we're not going to interpret it that way." And so Parliament intervened and clarified what it meant. Clarified, I put in speech marks. So that's the first remedy. The second remedy is stricter guidelines to the courts about the process they must follow when interpreting Parliament's words. The third one is to define what they mean by the rule of law, and I that probably requires a little bit of elaboration. And the fourth one is tweaking judicial appointment processes, with the most radical aspect of that a suggestion that we have fixed terms for Supreme Court judges. So they come up out of the Court of Appeal, serve their term on the Supreme Court, and then go back to the Court of Appeal. An alternative would be just to make the Supreme Court a second round of appeal with judges selected at random from the Court of Appeal to hear appeals from the Court of Appeal, judges who weren't involved in the case below. That would be another alternative. And that would keep our Supreme Court judges a little bit more grounded.
What's the situation with the judge now? They're appointed till when?
Till age 70.
Okay.
So if they get to the Supreme Court at 55, they'll have 15 years on the Supreme Court. Or if they're appointed at 50, they'll have 20 years on the Supreme Court.
And, of course, in the United States, it's till death.
Yes, and I think you do need an age limit, whether 70 is the right one or it should be 75. You don't want judges suffering from cognitive impairment, and you don't want to subject them to regular testing either. So I think the US rule's suboptimal. Whether 70 or 75 is the right age is something we might discuss. I don't mean you and me, but it could be, you know, that's something for discussion or debate. But the idea is that for our highest court, we set fixed terms. And that's not without precedent, especially in countries with constitutional courts where constitutional court members serve for a term. That's the case in Germany. It's the case in South Africa and elsewhere. So term limits are not unusual for the highest court. Of course, our Supreme Court's not a constitutional court because we don't have a written constitution, but term limits per se will keep the judges more grounded. The Supreme Court, on average, delivers about 20 judgments a year, and in the Court of Appeal, hundreds. So they're much more involved in the nitty-gritty of the law.
What's been the feedback from members of the profession? Obviously, the people you're close to are on board, but what's been the general feedback your report?
I think I've had nothing but positive feedback. It's been limited so far from the profession. It's only a few days since the report mm-hmm. came out, but generally it's been supportive. As I've been out and about this week in Auckland, I've had a lot of people expressing support for it from the profession. It would be fair to say it's not had quite the same response from two professors at the law schools who I've seen comments from appear to be largely aligned with the approach of the Supreme Court. That's no surprise to me. But I think there is a caution there. If your values align with the direction in which the Supreme Court appears to be taking the law, then you're more likely to be inclined with the Supreme Court taking the law in that direction. And that was true in the US, with Democrats happy with a progressive approach from the US Supreme Court. Now that the US Supreme Court's dominated by conservatives, conservatives like it and progressives are up in arms. And that's the undesirable situation I think we must avoid, where we've got a politicized court and it matters who's appointed to it. So three broad categories of reform suggested. Parliament shouldn't hesitate to overturn decisions where it thinks the courts have taken the law off in the wrong direction. Labor did that most recently in D and the Police concerning the retrospective application of the sex offenders registration. The current government is proposing to do that in relation to the Marine and Coastal Areas Act case. In the past, these sorts of corrective decisions have been relative, in response to particular court decisions, have been relatively rare. But that's because we haven't had a Supreme Court in the past so determined to take the law in a particular direction, or a court giving itself so much license when it comes to interpreting Parliament's words.
Just a final point, Roger. It must be hard for you, because this is your career, this is your life. There is a majesty in the law. It's a wonderful, beautiful thing, properly understood in terms of allowing our society to jog along. And to see it from the top being what I would call undermined, very disheartening.
It is very disheartening. And I didn't expect 2024 to involve me dedicating a big chunk of my time for the initiative to writing about the Supreme Court. In fact, it was probably the last thing I thought I was going to be doing.
Mm.
I've spent most of the last 9 years since I left legal practice at my former law firm, writing on public policy generally and a lot on economics. But I have had a long career in the law. I've had a lifelong interest in legal theory. I got drawn back into it by a combination of events, a couple of wayward court decisions which I wrote about, one wayward, that's for sure, the Make It 16 voting age case, and one that really puzzled me, the Smith and Fonterra case.
Mm.
And then
the climate change one.
The climate change case.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you could spend an interview on that. It's a very good report, listeners. Roger Partridge is the chair of the New Zealand Initiative. You'll be familiar with that because we've spoken to many members of it. But this report is a very readable report. It's very slim. You can get through it in a casual couple of hours. Very important to the future direction of New Zealand. Because are we going to be able to vote for our laws, or are they going to be decided by people who we may not know their names now, but will soon be getting to know their names if they carry on like they are doing? And what can a citizen do about it? Because with Parliament, we can peacefully vote them out. Our Supreme Court, we like them to be there and to be stable and not have to pander to our wants and our needs, but rather to sit there on high interpreting the law. When they start making it, well, they're making themselves accountable to us again. And that's what's up in play. Our very structure of our Westminster system. Roger Partridge, the book is called Who Makes the Law? Reigning in the Supreme Court. It's put out by the New Zealand Initiative. You can find it online. It is free. Well worth a read. Roger, thank you for coming on this morning. And thank you for writing such a thoroughly good read. And what I'd say is the most important report to come out in New Zealand this year.
Thank you, Rodney.
Mm. There you have it. Real talk with Rodney Hyde on Rally Check Radio. Remember, send us a text 2057. Email us inbox at rallycheck.radio. We're truly blessed with our guests, are we not?
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.